It's podcast time. I'm Rob Brown with the Inside Public Accounting Podcast. Thrilled to have with me today Brennan Pope from the Accountant's Flight Plan Podcast. Good day to you, Brennan.
Hi, Rob. Good to see you.
It is good, too. From across the pond, we're doing a dual joint crossover episode. It's all exciting. We're breaking new ground, Brennan. I'm going to say a little bit about our show in a moment, but tell us about your Accountant's Flight Plan Podcast.
Yeah, so we've had this podcast for, gosh, I think we started it in 2011. Or 2012, somewhere a long time ago. And we really run the gamut. You know, our main business is mergers and acquisitions. So we do have a lot of conversations around that. But I find that a lot of my conversations are really more about practice management because most of the people who are selling really need to think about how to optimize their firms. So a lot of our content is around optimization. I'm also really interested in the entrepreneurial community. So I'll bring people in outside of the industry, kind of infuse some of those just entrepreneurial topics and bring them to the accounting profession.
Yeah. Well, our regular audience will know Chelsea Summers, Executive Director of Inside Public Accounting. Chelsea and I host this show, and we deep dive on the excellent research that they do, like the IPA 500 and the Rosenberg Survey. We look at the bigger picture. You're a little bit more in the weeds and exactly what works, but Chelsea's really good at drawing out the stats and the facts, and we look at the stories behind those and what it all means. So this is new ground. This is brand new, and we've got a few topics that we're going to have a conversation with Brennan today, aren't we? And we're going to start with the state of CPA firm M&A. You are uniquely qualified to talk about this. So give us a sense of the landscape right now, because there's a lot happening, isn't there?
There is. I actually just went to a Harvard Business School conference on private equity in Boston. Wow. A couple of weeks ago. I wrote a blog post about it, but it's an interesting time. It's really, I've been in M&A since 2003, and this is probably one of the most exciting periods of M&A in this industry that I've observed.
Exciting. Do you mean frenetic and absolutely crazy and so much going on?
It's a little crazy. It is. And, you know, hindsight's 2020 to see this coming. I feel like what has happened is the accounting industry has not changed itself very rapidly. I think the accounting industry is historically slow to change, slow to adopt new ideas. And now you've got private equity, which is a growing, private markets in general are growing. Well, that was one of the themes of the conference that I just went to is, you know, from about 2002, the amount of private equity in the economy in the United States has grown exponentially, and it continues to become a larger and larger share of investments in people's in total capital invested. And there's less companies going public now due to various regulations and things like that. So it's sort of put a lot of capital into the private markets, which are finding its way into all sorts of different industries. And that's what we're experiencing in the accounting industry. Yeah. And I think what's really kind of where the stars have lined up for private equity in our industry is we kind of tick all the boxes for them. We've got recurring revenue. We've got kind of a slower adoption of technology and good management systems. A lot of firms are not optimized, and there's a lot of small fragmented, it's a small fragmented market. So there's just a lot of opportunity when you add scale. The entities become more stable, they become more predictable, and they become more valuable. And so that's the whole reason for the private equity interest in this, is because they can, you know, they can grow through acquisition, roll up. It's just a very traditional roll-up strategy. You roll these firms up, you have a bigger, more predictable, more valuable entity. As they get larger, the multiples get higher. So that's the benefit to the consolidators, is they can kind of buy low and sell high. That's the name of the game.
It's a recurring theme on our shows. canon where we talk about how disruptive private equity is, but how pervasive it is, because it is everywhere. So the top 30 firms have either taken or are having private equity conversations. And the IPA do the IPA 500, and there's so much moving around and firms getting bigger, and these all the M&A stuff is changing the landscape of accounting. What you've talked a little bit about the drivers, which is making people merge, buy or sell. How much harder is it these days for firms to stay independent and resist the temptation of the PE dollar?
Well, I don't know. That's a great question. I think,
because there's a lot to be said for that injection of capital, isn't it? It releases the partners from the equity bind. It allows succession in the firm. It makes them probably a lot more able to buy great technology and attract best talent with the salaries that they're able to afford. So it does do a lot for a firm.
It does. I do think there's definitely a trade-off, though. And
yes,
you lose control. You lose some of that kind of family feeling of, that some firms are proud to have. And I think, I don't know how you resist the temptation. I wouldn't, you know, I think if someone wants to exit and they find the right fit from a private equity firm, then that can be a good solution for them. If they don't find a right fit, whether it's a private equity firm or any other buyer, there are going to be problems with the transition and the problems potentially with how the firm operates after that closing. I think the fit is really maybe even more important when you're looking at different private equity firms. And I think that's I see a lot of firms, they get tempted by what I call the headline offer, you know, and the headline offer sounds amazing. It's not unlike an NFL player's headline offer. You know, you hear about these amazing $50 million contracts. And then when you read the fine print, it's like, oh, but they only get like $2 million at signing. And then all the rest of the money is very conditional on certain metrics, which may or may not be achievable. It's no different with private equity. So some of the headline offers might be enticing, but I think the danger is, if you go too fast and you don't really slow down and assess the fit well, and you just go right into negotiating mode, you can have a bad fit.
Yeah. Well, I was speaking to somebody yesterday who's a former leader of one of the big global networks associations, and he said to me, most PE deals don't work. Now, I don't know his evidence behind that, but there's so many ways to define whether it's worked or not, and which parties has it worked for, because there's a few different stakeholders in the deal, isn't there? And he says it's the same for M&A. There's so many people moving at speed to put deals together, and you can only do so much due diligence, and it's really hard to gauge things like culture. The softer stuff, you can't put a price on that, and you've smashed two brands together, like putting Coca-Cola with Panda Pops or something like that. I don't know if you have Panda Pops over the pond, but it's the small mom and pop type operation. You put those two cultures together and you're in for trouble. So there's a lot at stake here, isn't there, Brandon?
There is. And I think I just see a lot of firm owners get enticed into a discussion with a headline offer. To your point about deals not working, a lot of them never make it to the finish line.
True that, yes.
Because sometimes it just becomes apparent when you're dealing with someone that this is not going to work. Like, you just feel like, okay, the way they made that decision, I would never make that decision. Or the way they treat their team, I would not treat my team this way. Or whatever it might be, those things do get revealed sometimes and the deals don't go through. And what we see a lot of times with PE firms is, you know, they'll put out multiple letters of intent, but the ratio of the ones they close is pretty low.
There's an aspect too, Brandon, isn't there, of what they call a distressed sale, where the seller is very motivated to get out. 25% of CPAs are at or close to retirement age. So this whole swathe of people at the top end that need to divest themselves of their firm. They want to offload. They they're not selling it to their staff, or they can't. There's no other offers on the table. So they are really open to any kind of deal that's put to them, whether it's a good fit or not.
And I think that might be, I would sort of challenge that perception, because right. You know, that's kind of the value that we play in the marketplace, is we give people a lot of choices and a lot of options to buyers.
Yeah.
And I think that's fundamentally the value that we bring, and, you know, coupled that with the guidance of helping make those choices, I think people actually have a lot of options. The market's very strong. If you're a seller, you're in a pretty good position right now, for the most part. Now, that markets vary and practice quality is important, and, you know, there are things to consider there. It's nuanced, but in general, it's a pretty strong market. If you own a firm and you want to exit, I would say you have more options now than you've ever had.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. Tell us the difference between taking an offer from a private equity company and taking an offer for another accounting firm.
Well, sometimes that can be, that water can be a little muddy too, because sometimes there are a lot of CPA firms that have private equity backing.
True. Yeah, there is that. Could be the same buyer, couldn't it, really?
So, yeah, so they have a capital infusion and they're making acquisitions, but they're still a CPA firm and they operate the way a CPA firm operates, and they have that experience and that history. And those can be really quite good buyers for people. Whereas, you know, just someone pursuing a roll-up strategy that hasn't been doing this for very long, that's a little different flavor of private equity. So, but, you know, we have all sorts of buyers. There's still a lot of buyers in the marketplace. There's still individual buyers in the marketplace. There are other firms that are not PE backed. And then you've got the two that we spoke about, like pure PE firms or family offices, and then the CPA who are backed by PE. I encourage our clients, talk to everybody. Like, talk to anybody that you know has serious interest in your practice and has the experience and you feel like can run the practice. Talk to all of them. There is a difference in the deal making, pretty big difference in the deal making.
I wanted to ask you if there's anything that's misunderstood about, say, private equity backed transactions. There's a lot maybe that owners don't know.
Well, my experience has been they are more complex, because and almost, you know, if you think about, if you put yourself in the shoes of the private equity or the family office, their intent is to create a pretty large entity that they're eventually probably going to sell to a larger buyer at some point. Uh-huh. So all of their legal work has to stand up to investor scrutiny, and it has to be bankable. So a lot of the times the strategy is, you know, they're going to buy these firms, but then they're going to leverage them later on, or leverage the entity later on. So, you know, when they go to apply for financing, everything's got to be very orderly in terms of the paperwork and the structures. So that creates some complexity that you just don't have with individual buyers or traditional firm buyers.
I spoke to a lady called Lucy Cohen recently. She is the first owner of a £1 million firm here in the UK. She's now president of the AAT, the Association of Accounting Technicians. A very colorful character, but very vibrant and edgy is Lucy. She has private equity money behind her firm, Mazuma. And she talked about how intense the process was and all the due diligence that was done by the firm and all the metrics they wanted and the forms that needed filling out. She said it was exhausting. Do you get feedback like that from some of the people you're working with?
Yeah, it is. It is definitely a more complex process, and it's not, you know, we try to simplify it.
Yeah.
I have had PE firms buy from us on really relatively simple contracts.
Okay.
When they're in again, it's that competitive process. Like, they don't want you to have competition. They don't want you to have backup offers. But if you do, if you do, not only can you get a better deal, but you can make sure you don't get pulled around during that process as much.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We know many of you listen to this podcast on the go, driving to work, working out, even doing chores. Now you can get CPE credit for that time. With Earmark, you can earn free NASBA-approved CPE for listening to the Inside Public Accounting podcast. After you listen to an episode, take a quiz, and your certificate will be ready. Earmark has courses for everyone in your firm, from staff to partners. Get started today at earmark.app or download the free app on the App Store.
Talk to us about some of the signals of knowing when to sell. There's internal signals and external signals that you speak a lot about, Brandon.
I think the timing is the hardest decision people have to make, is when is it time to sell?
Like when to have children. There's never a perfect time to have children.
Yeah, that's a good. No, I've never heard that analogy, Rob. That is really good. That is awesome. I think it's, you know.
But there are signals, Brandon, aren't there? There are signals when the time is more preferential than other times.
Well, the market's good. The market is one thing. But what I've learned is selling is not about just getting top dollar. Selling is about your time, basically. So what I mean by that is either you want to spend your time living, you know, if you're at retirement age, it really boils down to time. Because if you keep working, you're probably going to make more money, right? Mm. Even in this phase right now, the market's good, but the market will probably be good in 2 or 3 years from now, too. So every seller is going to have to do that math of like, okay, yeah, I could sell now and exit for X, but if I work 2 more years and still sell for X plus, well, gosh, I'm financially better off.
Mm.
And if you keep doing that math all the way out, you're probably always going to be better off if you keep working financially. So that's why I say, like, financially, this is not, exiting is not necessarily a financial decision unless you've got a bigger opportunity. So I think there's opportunity cost. And whether you're working or not, there's opportunity cost, right? If you're retiring, your time becomes way more important than the money that you have, right? And so when you've reached that point of, I have enough money and now time is more important to me than money, it's time to exit, right? That's really, when someone's leaving for retirement, that is ultimately the decision they have to come to grips with. Now, if someone's younger and they still have a lot of career left and they still want to work and they're not really trying to go travel the world and play golf every day, then that's a different decision. And that's, hey, what do I want to do with my career spending time? And so either they have an entrepreneurial venture they want to go after, we've had clients like that, or they really want to elevate their role. And private equity can be a really good solution for those people. If, hey, I'm good at getting new business, I'm good at growing, but gosh, this operational stuff is just killing me. I get pulled back into the weeds.
Yes.
I can't escape the weeds. Like, private equity can be great for that because you get immediate support and you can get really an elevated role in the firm. So, you know, that, I hope that sort of answered that question.
It does, yes. And Chelsea and I have spoken on the Inside Public Accounting podcast about those red flags or signals or green lights. For instance, if your firm has a good succession in place and you're ready to move on, that's a good signal. If you're feeling burnt out as the owner of the firm, or you've come to the end of the road, that's something. Plateau growth as well. You've seen firms start to level out. They've taken it as far as they can go. That's a signal. Or they may be dependent on one or two clients or one or two markets, one or two niches, and they can't expand beyond that. Or maybe even competition pressure. There's too many other players coming into the market and the owners are thinking, well, there's enough now. So there's plenty of signs that you should be looking at selling your firm, putting it on the market, aren't there? Would you add anything to that?
I think the only thing I would say is, like, burnout is really common.
Yes.
And I've seen a lot of people go down the path of exploring an exit to realize, like, oh, I just really need to fix my firm. You know, I need to get it to where I'm not working so many hours. I need to get, it needs an overhaul. And I think a lot of firms need an overhaul, which is why private equity sees so much opportunity, because they see a lot of firms that can be improved. And I would challenge that, gosh, just about any firm could be improved, right?
But as you say, it's a lifestyle thing, isn't it? There are so many aspects that point to mental health and stress and overload and pressure. And it's a different game, Brandon, now to what it was 20, 30 years ago.
It is, but I think a lot of those things are easier to fix than people realize. Like if you're working too many hours, you can fix that. If you're not making enough money in your practice, that could be fixed. Mm. Now, it's not going to be fixed if you keep doing what you've always been doing. You've got to change. And some people have to get to that point of burnout and look at an exit before they realize, like, man, I really just need a change.
Talk to us about what buyers want right now.
Different buyers want different things. In general, like the most attractive firms are profitable. You know, they're making a good margin, have good client bases, and the owners are not working too much. That's really, you know, it's funny, 20 years ago, I would find a firm where a seller was working crazy hours, you know.
Yeah.
I've seen people work over 3,500 hours a year, which I didn't even know there were that many hours in the year.
That's unsustainable though, isn't it?
It's not sustainable. But 20 years ago, buyers wouldn't, they would notice, but it wouldn't prevent them from pursuing that practice. Nowadays, a lot of buyers will just won't even look at that firm because it's way too owner dependent.
Yeah, dependency risks. Definitely.
So I think I think that's something that buyers are more in tune with. They're also looking for teams. I think a lot of the especially the private equity consolidators are more interested in the team than they are the client base. You know, finding really good people is difficult in this industry, and it's been a challenge for a number of years. So, you know, we're seeing a lot more emphasis put on teams.
Yeah. Just looking at some of the statistics from the Inside Public Accounting Practice Management Report came out last year, 21% of firms, Brandon, that participated in the survey have completed at least one merger in the past year. That's 21%. And for firms over 30 million in revenue, that jumps to 35%. That's over a third of firms have taken a deal. There's so many reasons for that, as you're hinting, but in the age of efficiency and technology, we're seeing a lot more desirable firms that have some kind of operational readiness, and they've got or are developing a good advisory mix. That's something else in the plan. They've got some kind of specialization. As you said, they've got a good team or a good leadership bench, and they're digitized as well. The technology is absorbed and integrated. So there are signs there, and a lot more firms have been able to compete that way, which is why nearly every firm is growing. Now, we could have an argument about whether that's the right kind of growth and at what expense, because you can just take on more clients and end up being a busy fool, can't you? But that right kind of predictable, process-driven firm with good growth, they're going to attract the best valuations.
Yes, I would agree with pretty much everything you just said. That's true. But you know, buyers, what I find is the systems are not necessarily the primary thought. Like the systems and processes aren't the primary thought, but they lead to the results that I was speaking of. Like they lead to that higher profitable, less owner dependent firm. So in order to get those things, you kind of have to have those processes and systems in place that are working. I think the hardest thing to kind of change out is like the client base itself. If you've got really good clients, if you've got a curated, high quality client base that pays good fees, like that's to me is a slower, harder thing to build than the systems and processes, and even than the team. Like, it takes time to build those really great curated client lists.
I'm just wondering that the biggest deal last year, obviously, was the headline Baker Tilly Moss Adams merger at $7 billion to create the sixth largest firm in the U.S. That was announced in April. So we learned from that that no firms are too big to merge. Is there a number at the bottom end, Brandon, that tells us no firms are too small to merge or be bought?
Oh, gosh. I've never contemplated that question before. It was an interesting question. We don't see a lot of mergers kind of in the smaller, like under 5 million range.
No. There's a cutoff, isn't there?
I don't know why that is. I think there's a tendency if you're that size, like let's say you have a 2.5 million revenue firm, annual revenue. Yeah. One thing I've seen work well is if you're, you know, let's say you've got younger leadership team, they want to grow. It's a hard place to grow from 2.5 to 5 million is kind of a difficult place to be.
Yes.
But so making an acquisition of equal size is a great way to, to quickly elevate the practice.
Well, we're seeing so many firms on the consolidation trail right now. They're just mopping up other firms, and it's a great way to drive growth.
It is, because it gives you just kind of an instant benefit, that scale. You don't have to go through that difficult period of time to, you know, going from 2.5 to 5 million, building it organically can be really tough, getting the right team. Because what happens is, you never get that escape velocity. If you're a partner in that firm, you know, you might grow and then you lose a tax manager, or you lose a team member, and then you get pulled back down into the weeds, and then your growth kind of stalls because you can't focus on growth. You're focusing on getting the work out the door again.
We see some firms too that don't know whether they want to be buyers or sellers. If they're a mid-sized firm, they can be in both markets, can't they?
They can. I mean, at some point they got to decide though, right?
So. Exactly. You got to pick a lane. Yeah.
But, you know, it can be a very strategic thing to acquire if you're a smaller firm, to make that acquisition, because there's something somewhat magical when you get to 5 million. As if, let's say, you know, you have a small firm, and at that point, if you're at 5 million and you lose a tax manager, well, you can just spread the work around. Mm-hmm. And until you find some more help, it's not really going to slow you down. And as a partner or an owner, you're not going to get pulled back down into that role.
Yeah. Let's give some practical advice to firm owners. What should firms start doing today, Brandon, in this crazy market?
If they want to sell or get ready for a sale?
Give us an angle on both.
Okay. So, I think it's smart to really take stock of where your firm is, and take stock of the motivation of each of the partners. Is like, why do you want to do something? Who wants to exit? You know, I think there are a lot of situations where partners are not aligned. So you have to get that partner alignment, and sure, the exit timetables are not often quite aligned. You know, it's very common for one partner to be older and want to exit, and the other partner or partners don't want to exit. So I think getting that alignment first is really important if you want to exit. And also, you know, so determining your time, your ideal time frame is important. And, you know, forget the market for a minute, right? Just, I think you have to look internally and make sure it's the decision that's right for you and right for your firm. And if you've got time, if you say, okay, we got 3 years before we really want to exit, or we got a year or two, whatever it is, then you can sort of say, okay, how do we optimize, right? What do we need to do to really position ourselves well? What can we clean up? And that's a different answer for different firms. Some people have, I mean, firms, that's the one thing that I'll say, we've seen, you know, I don't know how many profit and loss statements I've seen from different CPA firms over the past 25 years, but I'm always shocked at the variety of success in firms. The variety of the experience of ownership, whether that be profitability, owner freedom, owner lack of freedom. There's just so much variety. Like they're being operated very, very, very differently. They run the gamut. So I think, you know, if you're kind of underperforming, then what's your problem? You got to diagnose it. Is it, and there are some common ones. Like one things I see that's really common is firms just aren't focused, meaning they're trying to be everything to everybody. And that's usually not a formula for good profitability. You know, I see firms that, okay, we've got this tax work and then we're doing audit work and then we're over here doing litigation support. And oh, by the way, we're also your wealth management outfit. And also we do, you know, peer review. I mean, it's like...
We'll do your website as well if you want us to, and we'll rebrand you.
You know, so a lot of people need to focus because organic growth, if you just leave it to nature, you're going to have weeds in your garden, you know?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the time what I see, if someone's going through an improvement process, it's counterintuitive, but often you have to start by pruning the things that need to go away from the practice.
That's just gardening 101, isn't it? You got to prune to grow.
You got to start pruning. So
completely understand. Well, you listen to a crossover episode with Brandon Poe on the Accountant's Flight Plan podcast and me, Rob Brown, and my absent co-host, Chelsea Summers. We host the Inside Public Accounting podcast. We've been talking today about the private equity world and mergers and acquisitions in the world of accounting. And if people want to find out more about your podcast and the kind of things you talk about, where would they go?
Best way is to just go to our website, which is pogroupadvisors.com, and you'll find a podcast page there. You can also find our podcast on YouTube and all the major platforms.
And what will they find when they get there? What kind of stuff are you putting out?
Well, gosh, you know, I talk about all kinds of stuff on our podcast. You'll find stuff from entrepreneurs outside of the profession, discussions about M&A, and a lot of discussions about practice improvement and optimization.
Haven't we just chastised accountants for trying to do too much in all these different service lines? And then you're telling me you'll find everything on our podcast.
Yeah, I know.
For everybody.
I know that's it's I'm not taking my own medicine. I probably should streamline it, but
that's okay. We call it diversifying, don't we? And covering a few bases. That's great too. Well, the Inside Public Accounting podcast is at insidepublicaccounting.com and on all of your podcast channels as well. We look at the accounting landscape and the statistics and the facts and what the good firms are doing to become great firms and what makes the best practice in firms really, really work. We're very big too on transparency of leadership, both in the accounting profession and the brand of accounting, but also in leadership, people at the top of firms, because we know that there could be an image problem in accounting. We talk a lot about talent on our show and how firms are changing. So let's all make it a better world for accounting. Brandon Poe, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be appearing on your show and you will be appearing on ours. So our viewers, listeners will have a double chance to get a listen to this. Thanks so much for joining us today. Brandon, just to leave the audience here, what's the one word of advice you would give, or the call to arms for accountants out there to really succeed and thrive?
Boundaries are your friend. Boundaries around your time. Boundaries around your pricing. Boundaries.
That's very profound. I'd add another P to that one. It's two words. I'd add personal brand, which might not seem significant in the grand scheme of things, but I'm always encouraging accountants to think a little bit more about their personal reputation and their network and how they show up. And so they've got a voice, they've got some influence, they've got some authority, they've got more cachet to make good decisions, and they've got more leverage in their career and their marketplace. I'd say that's really important as well. It's been a pleasure, Brandon. And in breaking new ground, we have given our audience some good things to think about. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Rob.